This is a CBC podcast. Know someone who's learning English as an additional language? Be sure to tell them about CBC Manitoba's weekly Learning English podcast. They can download language lessons and learn more about life in Manitoba at cbc.ca/podcasting.
I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas, with a program about how our earliest childhood experiences affect our health and our well-being as adults.
The important link between early childhood experience and adult health is to kind of understand how the roots of adult health problems probably begin much earlier than we think. A lot of our public health efforts to promote health focus on trying to get adults to eat better and exercise more and change some of their habits that are not good for their health. And this new research and growing knowledge base about the impact of early adversity really makes us stop and think about whether our approach to health promotion is starting way too late.
One of the curious facts about health is a phenomenon called the social gradient. In every country that's been studied, for every disease and disorder, there's a gradient, so that the poorer you are, or the lower you are in any social hierarchy, the less healthy you are. This is true even after you take things like smoking, diet, and exercise into account. Stress in adult life has been pinpointed as one of the contributing factors, but it alone hasn't been enough to explain this phenomenon. In this first program of a series, Jill Eisen talks to researchers who are going back to our beginnings and finding important links between our earliest years and our health as adults.
We know far more about the growth of pigs and sheep and cows than we do about the growth of humans. And that is because the growth of domestic animals is a major industry. We've got to start figuring out more about the growth of humans.
David Barker is a heart specialist and epidemiologist with appointments at both the Oregon Health and Science University and the University of Southampton in England. He's raised hackles in medical circles by claiming that how we grow in the womb and the first few years of life may have a greater influence on our health as adults than anything that comes after. I spoke with him at a conference center near Washington, D.C., and asked him to tell me about the Barker hypothesis.
25 years ago now, it became clear that we can't explain why one person gets heart disease and another does not through what people do in their later lives. That was a starting point for research, that people get heart disease because they eat the wrong thing, they smoke, and they don't take exercise, etc. Now, those things matter, but they matter much less than we'd thought 25 years ago. And the alternative explanation for heart disease and the other diseases that go with it, which include hypertension, diabetes, and stroke, is that people develop them because they are vulnerable. They are more vulnerable to what everybody does. So we set out the hypothesis that this vulnerability was acquired during early development. And furthermore, there was a very clear evidence that vulnerability was acquired in the womb rather than in childhood, though childhood does matter. And we set that out, and through the next 20 years, evidence has accumulated that people who were towards the lower end of the normal range of birth weight are at increased risk of this group of diseases from which most people in the Western world will die.
I'd like to know how you came about developing this theory.
We made a very detailed map of heart disease across England and Wales, and it then became obvious that coronary heart disease, which is commoner in the north and west of the country, mapped to death rates of infants 60, 70 years ago. And in the past, the commonest cause of death in newborn babies was low birth weight. So we had a very strong clue that low birth weight was linked to later heart disease. And it was possible then to find groups of men and women now in their later lives whose birth weight was recorded at the time and to directly link up individual birth weight with individual risk of heart disease.
When David Barker talks about low birth weight, he's not including premature babies. He's talking about babies who are small for their gestational age. A full-term baby weighing less than 5.5 pounds is considered small. In North America, about a quarter of all babies are under 5.5 pounds, and the majority of them are born to low-income mothers. Given this fact, I asked Dr. Barker how he knew that adult health problems were linked to low birth weight rather than to a lifetime of poverty.
Well, that's a very good point, and there have now been sufficient studies, including the American Nurses study, where it's been possible to look at people's social circumstances through their lives and see if it's the social circumstances rather than their size at birth which is causing later disease. And the answer is absolutely clear that whatever you take into account, being small at birth is a major risk factor for later disease.
So is there a gradient, the bigger you are? Yeah,
yes.
Can you tell me that?
Well, the relationship between birth weight and heart disease and diabetes is graded. And so it's better to be 8 pounds than 7 and better to be 9 pounds than 8. Now, the caveat on that is it depends what the 9 pounds is. If it's fat, which is what happens in women who have pre-diabetes or diabetes of pregnancy, that, of course, is not good. But if it's muscle or bone or brain, that is good. Growth is good.
David Barker believes that low birth weight is caused by the fetus not being sufficiently nourished. This in turn, he says, results in body organs that aren't as well developed and robust as those in larger babies, leaving the eventual adult vulnerable. It's a believable hypothesis, but it can't be the whole story. I wanted to know how significant low birth weight is compared to all the other factors that affect adult health.
It's possible to use data from the wonderful Helsinki birth cohort study, as it's called, which is a group of people born in Helsinki before and during the Second World War whose lives have been documented in great detail. And it is quite clear that if we optimize the path of growth of our children before birth and through the first 5 years or so of their lives, we could at least half the amount of diabetes. So these are very big effects. The other thing to say to your question, Jill, is this, that if people have good early development, they are resilient to stresses later on. And so if you get it right early, later life is much less important in terms of your health. And a good example of that is in the Helsinki birth cohort, men who have low incomes, who are poor, get more heart disease. Well, we knew that. It applies across North America and Europe. But actually, if you look at the men by how they were at birth, only men who were thin babies are vulnerable to the effects of poverty, whatever they may be, on the heart. So for three quarters of the men, it didn't matter what income they had in terms of their experience of heart disease.
By this time, all you mothers and mothers-to-be out there are probably thinking it's important to have a really good diet during pregnancy. Well, what Dr. Barker has to say may surprise you.
Babies do not depend on what the mother eats each day. That would be far too dangerous a strategy. Some mammals don't eat at all during pregnancy, seals, bears. So the human baby lives off the mother's body. The mother's body is a reflection of her lifetime nutrition. So that is what a baby lives off, the mother's lifetime nutrition. So many girls, young women, have come through difficult lives. They're short, they may be short and fat. They may have experienced malnutrition in their own infancies, and that plays out on the next generation. I mean, every time I articulate this, I realize how obvious it is, because every farmer across Canada and North America knows just that, that if you negative things happen to female animals, it plays out in the next generation.
Okay, so, I mean, big, huge question, but what do mothers need to produce healthy babies?
It's about variety, Jill. It's not about formulae. It's if you have a meal in Crete, which might cost you $3, you will eat 20 different kinds of food. In this place where we are talking, you might have to work quite hard to eat 20 different kinds of food in a single small meal. The American diet is monotonous and unbalanced, and illiterate peasants in southern Europe eat much better than the meals served in the White House. Variety covers all the bases. Everyone agrees there are things in food that we haven't yet identified which are very important. So only variety can cover the bases. There's no point in having a blind faith in pregnancy nutrition books, because they can only write about the things that we have identified. And so what we are trying to do, and the only real purpose of your program, could be to change the food choice culture in ways that benefit the growth of girls and young women.
David Barker isn't saying that what we do as adults isn't important, and he certainly wouldn't counsel abandoning healthy lifestyles. In fact, if you're vulnerable, healthy lifestyles are especially important. But his ideas have contradicted prevailing theories about health, and he's been met with many a hostile reception. I talked about the Barker hypothesis with Michael Meany. He's a neuroscientist at McGill University with a special interest in how the stress hormones, or glucocorticoids, influence early development. He remembers the initial reaction to David Barker's work.
There was great skepticism. In fact, many of the great replications, successful replications, were led by people who were convinced that this was all hogwash. And it's been replicated across Western Europe, Southeast Asia, Australia, the United States, Canada, etc. It's a very poignant effect. Now, what we have to understand here that's critical is that this is correlational data. So it doesn't say that birth weight causes you to become diabetic, but it does indicate that there's a risk associated with that. So we need to dig a little deeply into this literature. And what the low birth weight really reflects is, if you will, to some extent, a failure of fetal growth. It means growth during the fetal period wasn't as good as it should have been. Nutrition is one of the major determinants of fetal growth, but it's not the only one. And in fact, if you actually look at the endocrine systems that give rise to impoverished fetal growth, that they include stress hormones. They include the glucocorticoids. The deprivation of protein and other major nutrients can cause an increase in the fetus exposure, the fetal exposure to glucocorticoids. So too can smoking, tobacco use, maternal stress, etc. And all of those factors increase glucocorticoid production. And we know from studies that were done at Cornell in the early 90s that indeed it is the glucocorticoids that seem to be causing the restriction of the growth in the fetus. So all of these factors, nutrition, tobacco, alcohol, maternal stress, they can all produce impoverished fetal growth. So then we can ask the question, well, okay, but why do these effects endure? Well, I mean, you don't become diabetic in some cases until maybe your mid-50s. Well, glucocorticoids in the fetus can alter the activity of genes in the liver. They include effects on genes that are involved in your ability to metabolize glucose, your production of lipids or fats. And so right away you're setting the stage, if you will, for these very meaningful differences in the way in which the liver processes nutrients, metabolizes glucose, and turns out fats. And so you can actually see that what's happening then is that the same hormones that are restricting growth are also acting at the liver to determine the activity of genes in the liver that will then later on in life determine the ability of the individual to properly control their glucose and lipid levels. And that seems to be, to date anyway, the most meaningful understanding of this particular relationship.
There's one major caveat to the notion that low birth weight leads to heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. On further investigation, David Barker found that the relationship only held if small babies gained weight rapidly in the first few years of life. If they kept a fairly lean body mass index, they were at no greater risk than larger babies. The irony is that given the typical high-calorie Western diet, small babies are more likely to gain weight rapidly than are babies who were heavier at birth. Michael Meany.
Well, you can imagine the logic here. The fetus is deprived of glucose because of nutrient deprivation, or it's tricked into thinking that there's nutrient deprivation by high levels of glucocorticoids from the mother, from her stressors, or through alcohol or tobacco. In either case, the fetus is saying, look, this is not going to be a terribly pleasant place into which I'm being born. I had better come prepared to be able to make the most of whatever glucose and lipids that are available to me. So I'm going to program the activity of the genes in order to be able to maximize the glucose and lipids that are available. And then suddenly, instead of being born into an environment dearth of nutrients, I'm into McDonald's and Burger King, right? And so my problem here is I have a mismatch between the world into which I thought I was being born, into which I've been prepared, and the world in which I now find myself. And again, that biases us towards obesity. And so that point, I think, is well taken. But if you don't become obese, if you can move beyond McDonald's and onto slightly more advisable nutrient basis, then you can free yourself of this particular risk for heart disease and diabetes.
You're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio, Channel 137, and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. This is the first episode of Jill Eisen's series examining the links between early childhood and adult health and well-being.
The Barker hypothesis is now taken very seriously, and it's spawned a new wave of research into the early origins of adult disease. Researchers are investigating links between fetal and early childhood development and a variety of chronic health problems, from heart disease to various forms of cancer to osteoporosis. Charles Nelson is taking another tack. He's a professor of pediatrics and neuroscience at Harvard University.
There are probably lots of examples of early events that have big implications for health outcomes. The more interesting question in my mind is, how about psychological health, not just physical health? And the question is, are there things that happen early that can have a profound impact on psychological development later on?
The brain is the locus of psychological development, and the human brain is far from complete at birth. A baby's brain doubles in size in the first year of life and continues its growth spurt throughout the second year. It's during these years that the human brain is most plastic or sensitive to the environment around it. As Charles Nelson says, unlike other organs, after birth, the human brain depends more on experience than on genetic programming for its development.
There has historically been a very deterministic view of development, which is we have a set of genes, and those genes regulate the course of our development, and that's the end of the story, much the way our eye color is determined, for example. We actually know that that's not true at all, that there are, in fact, a fair number of genes that dictate the course of brain development prenatally. But often what these genes are doing is sort of laying the foundation and then leaving it to environments or experiences to sculpt the rest of the course of development. And one way we know that works is that we massively overproduce both brain cells, neurons, and synapses, the connections between neurons. And by massively overproduce, I mean that the newborn has many, many, many more neurons and synapses than the adult will. And the normal process is to actually prune those back, and it's experience that does that pruning. And we assume that what happens is that we overproduce, for example, synapses in order to capture experience. And as time goes by, if certain experiences haven't occurred, then those synapses get retracted, and we eventually wind up with the adult number. And this brings with it the concept of a sensitive period, that during, for example, the first few years of life, if certain experiences haven't occurred by that point, then the brain starts to get more crystallized or set in its way, and it gets harder to change. And the classic example we often use is in vision. A baby who's born with cross-eyed, who's cross-eyed or maybe wall-eyed, their eyes can go in or their eyes can go out. Unless that's corrected in the first few years, the baby will wind up having a very poor binocular depth perception, a type of depth perception that involves the two eyes. But if it is corrected successfully in the first few years, then the brain can take advantage of that and rewire itself. But after that, it's too late. So if you don't correct this disorder early, you'll never have normal vision.
The best way to understand the impact of experience on brain development is to study the effects of deprivation. There have been a lot of animal studies over the years looking at the effects of maternal deprivation, but it's been harder to study the problem in humans. We've relied on a few of what Dr. Nelson calls natural experiments.
In our case, we've been looking at a sample of children in Romania who were abandoned at birth and then raised in institutions. And the question is, what is the impact of that deprivation? So in our work, what we did is essentially a randomized control trial. And what that means is the following. We started with a large sample of children, all of whom had been abandoned at birth and placed in institutions, and that, based on our pediatric screen, seemed to be reasonably healthy. They didn't have anything obvious wrong with them, like Down syndrome or fetal alcohol syndrome or anything like that. We studied these children. It wound up to be 136 of them, extensively using a lot of measures of both brain and behavior. And then after the baseline assessment, we randomly assigned half of those children to foster care. Now, we had to build the foster care because there was none there, and we could only identify roughly 58 families that met our rigid criteria for being a good foster care families. And that's what led to us being able to randomly assign only half the kids to foster care, because there were only half, that's the number of foster care families that actually existed. So we have then studied their development ever since, including a third group, which of these are kids who just live with their biological families in Bucharest, Romania. So that's sort of our in-country control group.
What were the conditions in these orphanages?
Let's start with the following observation. For babies, let's say these are babies under a year, there might be 15 babies in a room lying in cribs and one caregiver floating around someplace, usually in the hall smoking a cigarette. And as kids get older, the ratio of caregiver to children becomes even less favorable. Then it might become 20 to 1 instead of 15 to 1. There's very little, of course, in the way of perceptual stimulation. Often the walls are painted and the ceiling are white, so the babies don't have anything to look at. There's little in the way of language stimulation or cognitive stimulation because there's no one to talk to these kids. It's very regimented, meaning that all the kids are fed at the same point during the day, go to the bathroom at the same point, dress the same way, have similar haircuts. So this highly regimented routine of raising kids coupled with the deprivation leads to, in a sense, deprivation of many sorts. The quashing of a sense of curiosity or of individual identity, to being deprived of normal language input or normal cognitive stimulation.
Charles Nelson has been studying these children for 8 years now. Not surprisingly, he's found profound differences between the children who stayed in institutions for more than 2 years and the control group of normal children.
What characterizes the child who lives in an institution and grows up in an institution is they have vastly diminished cognitive capacity. Their IQ is, instead of being 100, might be 70. They have greatly reduced language function, both expressive language and receptive language. Their language, again, might be, if 100 is normal, their language scores might be 65. They have attachment disorders. An example of that would be they're indiscriminately friendly. A child, a four-year-old, will look at a complete stranger and walk off with them without thinking about it. They're quite likely to be anxious. Many may be depressed. Many may have a problem regulating their attention. And the other thing on the physical side is they tend to be very small. They're short and they're thin. And that's a big issue. I have pictures of children who are, say, 17 years old who maybe come up to your thigh. And the observation is that for every month you spend in a bad institution, you lose a month of linear growth. So if you do the math, you can imagine after 10 years how small you'd be.
One of the lessons Charles Nelson hoped to learn was just how plastic the brain is in the early years. In other words, Were these developmental handicaps permanent, or could they be ameliorated with the proper intervention? And if so, was there some critical period before which that intervention had to happen?
What we find is the prevalence of attachment problems is very, very high in institutionalized kids. And what we find is that when the kids are placed in foster care, particularly if they're placed before 2 years old, then the prevalence drops by at least half. So attachment problems declines dramatically when kids are placed in foster care before the age of two. Now, after two, it's a little dicier, and that goes for other domains as well, meaning that after two, I'll use the example of IQ. We published a paper in Science last December that showed that the average IQ of kids in the institution was in the low 70s. The average IQ of kids in foster care was about 8 to 10 points higher. That alone is really great. But when you looked at this issue of timing of intervention, we found that kids placed before 2 had IQs that were appreciably higher than kids placed after 2. In fact, kids placed after 2 had IQs that were just a little above the institutional group. So that's what we mean by a sensitive period. We find the same thing for language, except for language, it shifted a bit to the left. So instead of it being 24 months, it might be closer to 16 months. For attachment, it seems to be, again, around 2. So the good news is that the intervention is effective in ameliorating many of the negative outcomes of institutional life, but not all. It's most effective in some domains if it's done before the kids are 2. And importantly, in some of our analyses, like IQ, it isn't how long the child was in the intervention, it's when they were placed there. Now, there are some surprising findings. Let's take mental health. When the children were 54 months old, we did what's called a structured psychiatric interview, which means that we sit down with the caregiver and we ask the caregiver hundreds and hundreds of questions about their child's mental health, basically. We find that the kids in the institution are profoundly affected in the sphere of mental health, that, for example, something like 40% of them have an anxiety disorder, and 8% of them, and these are 4.5-year-olds, 8% have a depression, and 20% have ADHD. And these are not symptoms of, these are bona fide disorders of, all right? Kids in the, if you look at foster care, we dramatically reduce the prevalence of anxiety and depression by half. We go from 40% anxiety to 20% anxiety. We go from 8% depression to less than 4%. But we're having no impact on ADHD and conduct problems. We divide the world into internalizing problems and externalizing. So the intervention is not having an effect on externalizing problems. And there are no timing effects here. So if a kid goes into foster care, it doesn't matter how old they are. If they go in, they become less anxious and less depressed, but it doesn't impact their behavior. So some domains aren't benefiting from the foster care, possibly because the average age of placement was 22 months. So it could have just been we put the kids in too late.
The reason some of these effects are so long-lasting, says Charles Nelson, is that early adversity literally gets under the skin and affects the physical structure of the brain.
The amygdala, for example, is this almond-shaped structure deep in the brain that is involved in emotion, and mostly the production of emotion, but also a number of other important functions. We think that, for example, the children in the institutional group may have a larger amygdala. One prediction, of course, would be smaller, but the reason we think it might be bigger is that the brain needs stimulation. And what's happening in these cases is think of profound neglect. What we think happens is that the brain is starved for stimulation, so it kind of gets overstimulated. And one way you see that is the prevalence of what are referred to as stereotypies, hand flapping, rocking, things like that. They're self-stimulatory activities. Whether they're calming the child or it's something the child does to stimulate himself or herself, we don't know. So we think what's happened is that when the brain is sitting around and not getting stimulated, it has this heightened state of arousal, and that may lead to an amygdala that's too large. We know that the ability to regulate emotion is profoundly impacted in these kids, and we know that ability is performed in part by a part of the front of the head, the prefrontal cortex, which has ties to the amygdala. So that's another area. The third is that there's an area of the brain called the hippocampus that's very involved in memory. And we know that kids living, anyone living with chronic stress, winds up with a smaller hippocampus and a poorer memory.
You talk about the severe deprivation that these orphans were experiencing, and it's just hard to believe that that would be applicable to situations in North America,
sure,
but
right.
How widespread?
So a common question I get is, how similar are the conditions in which we find ourselves in Romania to what you would see in anywhere else in the world, North America, Europe? And it's simply an extreme case of a similar phenomenon. If you look at children in the U.S. who are involved in what's referred to as the child protection system, this is when social workers and the legal and the court system might get involved in kids who are being neglected or abused. It's not uncommon to see kids who are suffering from neglect. Now, the neglect they experience isn't as profound as it is in Romania, but it's, you know, just a little bit less profound. So we think it does generalize, and we know from the scientific literature that kids who are neglected have much worse outcomes than kids who are abused, which is shocking to many people. People just assume that if you've been physically abused or sexually abused, you'll have a bad outcome. And you may have a bad outcome. What I'm saying is you'll have a worse outcome if you were neglected. And again, the reason is that the brain is sitting here waiting to have experiences. And if it doesn't have those experiences, it doesn't get wired correctly. And as a result, you wind up with significant problems.
So just what does the developing brain need for a healthy outcome? To find out, I spoke with Jack Shonkoff. He's director of the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University and co-editor of From Neurons to Neighborhoods, The Science of Early Child Development.
What's wonderful about this is that we have a convergence of decades of good research from both the behavioral and developmental sciences and now from neuroscience and molecular biology that are really coming together on a relatively short list of what the brain needs to develop well. And we could begin by really talking about, four areas, okay? The brain, first of all, healthy development depends on the availability of stable, protective, nurturing, predictable relationships with a relatively few number of adults. Humans are the most helpless at birth and for the longest time compared to any other animal species. And so the brain needs relationships, predictable, stable relationships in order to develop in a good way. The brain also needs to be exposed to good opportunities for learning, a variety of opportunities for learning that are appropriate for the child's age. Those are really the two key ingredients, but two others that I think we need to also not forget about are the need for the brain to live in a safe physical environment where it's protected from toxins, where it's protected from a greater risk for injury, where the supervision and the nature of the environment protects children from injuries. In fact, injuries are the most common cause of death after the first year of life, and certainly pose a real threat. And finally, the brain needs good nutrition. It needs calories and certainly particularly proteins and essential fats and micronutrients in order to develop well. So good nutrition, a safe environment, stable nurturing relationships, and good learning experiences are the key to healthy brain development and all of the things that follow.
A safe environment, opportunities to learn, and good nutrition are important at all stages of development. But what's especially important in the first year of life is a relationship with a parent who is attuned and responsive to their child, who's available to engage with the child in what Jack Shonkoff calls serve and return.
The term serve and return is our way of trying to speak in plain English to describe to non-scientists what developmental researchers call contingent reciprocity. How's that for a mouthful? What we mean by that is that the impact of relationships, the reason relationships are so important for brain development is that it's a two-way street. Children are not passive sponges that just take things in. They're very actively involved in their environment. So if we start right at the beginning in early infancy, babies cry, and the people who care for them have to figure out why they're crying. Are they crying because they're hungry? Are they crying because they're in pain? Are they crying because they're just kind of agitated? Okay, so when babies cry, when they vocalize, when they smile, and as they get older, when they coo, they babble, when children make sounds and adults respond back to them, when children make gestures. That back and forth, that reciprocal interaction, what we call serve and return, like in tennis or volleyball, the child does something, the adult responds back based on what the child does. The adult does something, and the child responds. So when the child and the child's important adults in his or her life are in sync, and in the beginning, you know, the burden is more on the adult than on the child. And children are all different. So some kids are easy to connect to. Other kids take a little bit more time, all within a normal range. And so the important point here is that it's the back and forth, it's the serve and return, it's the reciprocity that's essential for healthy development. It's not a one-way street. So, for example, very young children don't learn from being put in front of a television. That's not a two-way interaction. They don't learn from so-called educational, you know, CDs or tape recordings. They learn from another human being reacting to what they're doing. It has to be contingent, and that's what we mean by serve and return.
Our brains, it seems, are wired to connect. It's through interaction with an attuned, caring adult that our neural circuits are built in the early years. That interaction affects everything from our sensory circuits to circuits that regulate our emotions, our impulse control, our hormonal systems, and our abilities to learn and to connect with others. The majority of families provide this kind of interaction naturally, but under conditions of adversity, it's not so easy. Although poverty is difficult at any stage in life, Dr. Shonkoff says it's particularly difficult in the early years.
The reason poverty is particularly difficult in early childhood is because the stresses on daily life for families that can't predictably put food on the table every day and have to worry about keeping a roof over their heads and have to worry about being able to buy warm clothing in the winter, that level of poverty creates a constant background of tension and stress in family life that has some potentially detrimental effects on children's engagement with the adults in their family. It has nothing to do with how motivated and loving the family is. It has to do with the stresses they're dealing with. So there's less emotional availability to be responsive to the child. I mean, all of us know what it feels like to be very stressed, and we know that when we're under a lot of pressure, we have less patience. We're able to just kind of give less to the people around us. We have a shorter fuse for losing our temper. That's human nature, that everybody is susceptible to that. When a family is living with the constant stresses of poverty, it just puts more pressure on the parents in terms of their emotional availability, aside from just the material benefits available to the children. And that translates into a level of stress that the children can incorporate into their own bodies. You know, we have another big problem with poverty is the level of depression among low-income mothers. In most studies, we find rates of 40 to 50% of low-income mothers have serious problems with depression. Now, depression is not just a problem of low-income families. Depression occurs across the political spectrum, but it's much more prevalent among poor families. Maternal depression affects a mother's interaction with her child. She's less responsive. And we know from behavioral research that children living alone with depressed mothers over time develop more blunted affects themselves. They explore less. They're more subdued. And now we have from neuroscience evidence that there are changes in the brain activity of children who live with depressed mothers. Their EEGs, their brain waves, are actually different, reflecting the problem of interacting with a very depressed person. So these are the kinds of problems that are more serious when children are living in families under poverty, and it translates into real physiological effects on the development of the brain, which we could talk about if you'd like.
Stress in early childhood is one of the main contributors to physiological changes in the brain. But Jack Shonkoff cautions that not all forms of stress are equal. He breaks stress down into three main categories.
The first we call positive stress. This is kind of normative stress. It's the stress that's caused by having to share your toys. You know, the first day in a new child care center. These are stressful experiences for children, getting a shot at the doctor's office. They are a normal part of healthy development. Children need to have those experiences in order to learn to deal with stress. But the key thing about positive stress is it occurs in the context of a stable, protective relationship where there's an adult who helps you get through. So it's the first day in a new childcare center. A parent doesn't just like dump the child off and run away. You spend some time helping the child adjust. The staff spend time helping the child adjust. What's happening physiologically when adults do that is they're helping to reduce the threat, and the stress response system then goes back to baseline. So they're basically helping the body get back to a normal heart rate and normal blood pressure and get those stress hormone levels down. That's positive stress. It's good. It's health promoting. It's growth promoting. It's positive and normative. The next level of stress we call tolerable stress. This is stress that's associated with potentially really serious threats. This is the stress of having the death in a family. This is the stress of a serious injury or illness, the stress of being the survivor of a natural disaster like Hurricane Katrina or the tsunami in Asia or an earthquake, the stress of surviving an act of terrorism like 9/11 or much of the terrorism goes around the world. Here are stresses that potentially could have long-lasting emotional consequences. What we now know is a child form of post-traumatic stress disorder, okay, where children may be so stressed by a really serious threatening experience that they have long-lasting problems. So the question is, what makes this tolerable? How do we begin to understand why some children survive these experiences and do well, and others end up with the most serious emotional problems? Well, the question is, again, it's getting back to the basic physiology here. The key ingredient seems to be, are there adults who help the child get through that situation? It starts with the family. The family's most important to help a child get through a tough situation, but sometimes the family can't do it on their own, either because they're not available or because they're so traumatized. So neighbors, friends, they could provide that support. And sometimes even a formal program could do that. And sometimes we need formal programs and professional assistance. But whether it's the parents alone or the community or professional intervention, physiologically it's the same thing. We're giving the child a sense of mastery over that, saying you are not alone. We're going to help you get through this. You're going to be okay. And all of that stuff that everybody understands. And what's happening physiologically is that as the child feels that support, the stress response system goes back to baseline. Blood pressure comes down, heart rate comes down, stress hormones come down. So that can be threatening, but protected. That's why we call it tolerable. The third level is what we call toxic stress. And we spent a lot of time thinking about the right term. And some people said, well, toxic stress, that sounds like poisoning. And to some extent it is, on a physiological basis, because what toxic stress is a situation where the stress response system is overactivated, excessive, and for long periods of time, and there aren't any stable relationships to help you get through. So this is the stress associated with chronic abuse or neglect, living in a violent environment most of the time, the stress of living alone with a mother with a serious mental health problem like depression, who's unresponsive, not because she's a bad mother, but because she has an illness. The stress of living in a family with a serious substance abuse problem where the response to the child is erratic and not helpful. Any of those things signal to the child, this is a threatening, dangerous world. The stress response system is activated. All those systems are elevated, and there's nobody to help bring it down. And here's the problem. Let's take cortisol, for example, one of the most well-studied stress hormones. Short-term elevations of cortisol are very good for you because they help your body gear up to deal with threat. But if cortisol wasn't meant to stay up for a long period of time, and if it stays up, it actually can begin to be damaging to the body. And in fact, particularly to parts of the brain that are susceptible to persistently elevated cortisol. And in fact, the part of the brain that's the most sensitive to elevated cortisol is the hippocampus, which is where early memory and learning circuitry is built. So now we begin to develop some causal models for understanding what is it about toxic stress, and severe poverty would come into that category. Why does it lead to problems in school? It's not just distraction and motivation. issues. Children experiencing toxic stress actually have disruption of the circuits in their hippocampus at the time that those circuits are being developed. And so there can be faulty memory circuitry, which affects early learning. Similarly, if your heart rate and your blood pressure stay up and don't come down, that has a wear and tear effect on your cardiovascular system. And it begins to provide a model for understanding maybe why individuals who experience severe stress in their early life have more heart disease when they're older. Why do poor people have more diabetes? Why do they have more hypertension? Why do they have more heart disease? Why do they have more strokes when they're older? Why do they die earlier? Why do they not live as long? This is a whole area of research that Bruce McEwen first coined the term allostatic load, which is the wear and tear on the body of chronic stress, because the stress response system was meant to turn on and then turn off. It wasn't meant to be on all the time. So if you put all of these things together, we begin to get a picture of how to think about stress in early childhood.
So what kind of problems are you seeing with children who grew up in a kind of dysfunctional early situations?
Well, you know, the problems we're seeing in children who are growing up under kind of adverse circumstances are what we would expect from what we know about development and what we know about the underlying neurobiology and what we know about the impact of toxic stress. So what we see is children who have problems with learning, and some of that is related to attention and the ability to focus attention, and some of it is related to probably disruptions in their early memory circuitry and learning circuitry, and some of it is related to the fact that children are having problems regulating their behavior, which is one of the most important things that you learn early on, and you learn it in the context of relationships with people who help you kind of learn to regulate your own behavior. So we have increasing problems not only with learning difficulties, but with problems controlling aggression, problems interacting in a group. Children who really carry a burden of a huge amount of threat and stress in their life and are nervous or anxious or frightened. You know, I mean, I think for a long time people thought that young children can't have mental health problems. You know, they're fine, they're okay, or they're maybe a little, the behavior's a little out of line and they need to be disciplined or whatever. But we now know that children can have serious mental health problems. When people say, well, it's just in your head, that's true, but that means it's in your brain. And problems with anxiety and depression and attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity, you know, many of which are surely overdiagnosed. I mean, there are many children out there who have been diagnosed as having, hyperactivity or attention deficit disorder as a diagnosis. That's probably overdone. And for sure, there are increasing numbers of kids getting medications, some of whom are benefiting from it, but some of whom are probably getting medications that they shouldn't be getting. But with all of those caveats, the fact still remains that mental health problems in young children are real. They exist. And they exist in their brain circuitry. They exist, and we see them in their behavior. And when we notice it most, it's behavior that's acting out, behavior that makes life difficult for a lot of people around them. But as important to children whose behavioral and emotional problems are inner-directed, who are withdrawn and who are sad and who are not engaged. And I think the urgency of dealing with that as a moral responsibility is huge, given what we know now. I mean, in the old days, you could say, well, we didn't really understand. Now that we know, the responsibility to help these children is huge.
When it comes to helping children in the early years, our record in Canada is shameful. Close to one child in every nine grows up in poverty. And in a recent report for UNICEF, Canada tied for last place amongst 25 of the richest countries in providing for children in the early years. The attitude seems to be that the state has a responsibility to children once they reach school age, but before that, it's up to the family. It's an attitude Jack Shonkoff thinks is just plain wrong.
Clearly, children are raised by families. Nobody's arguing with that. The question is, can families provide what children need completely by themselves, or are there aspects of the larger environment that can help families to do their job? no family, regardless of how much money it has and how educated it is, raises kids alone. People who have resources can either buy some of the things they need, like good quality childcare or early education. That's something that certainly families with working parents don't provide that by themselves. They have to purchase that. A lot of what families need for support is provided as social capital in the communities they live in. They don't have to pay for it. But you have if you live in a community with strong social bonds, with good relationships with neighbors, and a lot of things that the community provides that supports parents, that helps the family do its job. If you have no money, if you're very poor, if you live in a community that has very little social capital, where there aren't resources in the community that are free, where there may be threats of crime as opposed to kind of safe places where people can go and just kind of hang out with their kids, then that creates a very different environment. So it's a little bit of a false dichotomy about talking about the difference between personal responsibility, individual responsibility, and shared responsibility, because nobody raises kids alone. Okay? The question is, how much should the government, in the United States at least, where people don't like to pay taxes, or at least a part of the population doesn't like to do that, people say, well, I don't want to have to pay, you know, for other people's children. Why don't they just take care of themselves? Well, you know, from my perspective, there are two responses to that. One's a personal response and one is a science-based response. The personal response really has to do with moral responsibility and ethical responsibility, which is if children are in trouble, we should care. And we should assume shared responsibility for making sure that no child lives below a certain level of decency and safety as a moral issue. It has nothing to do with science. Okay? But if we want to bring science to the table and we want to get away from just moral responsibility or broaden our view, then one can very easily make a very strong case for the social and economic investment aspects of shared responsibility for kids. And this is where our understanding of the impact of early experience on brain development and its influence on later learning and in later behavior and later health. So one could say the economic argument for government responsibility for supporting families in their job of raising their kids is that relatively modest, well-targeted investments early on to support families that need extra help will pale in terms of cost relative to the savings later of less special education costs, less public assistance costs, and the biggest cost is less incarceration. Okay, so this is just kind of smart investment. But to say that it's all about personal responsibility is kind of really putting your head in the sand, because nobody raises kids alone.
Investing in children is a legacy issue for politicians. The benefits won't be apparent until our current politicians are long out of office. But children represent our true infrastructure. Our success as a nation depends on how well we do by them. In part two of this series, I'll revisit the old nature-nurture debate to find what the latest research tells us about how genes and environment interact to shape us in the early years. I hope you'll join me.
On Ideas, you've been listening to the first episode of The Brains of Babes by freelance broadcaster Jill Eisen. Associate producer, Liz Nage. Technical production, Dave Field. To find out about upcoming Ideas programs and podcasts, sign up for our weekly online newsletter. Just go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas and follow the links. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. Stay tuned now for the hourly news on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite Radio.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.